And one other point, I believe Mr. Mayor told you he was an IRS consultant. And I believe Mr. Johnson said that that fact could have been brought out in cross-examination. Now what we will do is we will, I'm not sure what time we started, so you can just let me know how much time we have left. We will get into, just very peripherally, and I have to, again, strenuously.
Now, you have about an hour and a half.
Thank you, Mayor. I have to very much emphasize that this recitation of some of the evidence that we're going to go over and perhaps some of the legal conclusions that can be drawn therefrom is intended to be a very peripheral framework and outline of what the interests of the city are, what the city should inquire into in connection with the evidence, and what ordinances can result from the evidence. It's only intended to give you some idea of the areas that you could be looking into, and to collate and present to you some of the evidence as it correlates to each other, to different pieces of evidence.
Well, you need the overhead.
It basically will depend on the time. We may need it. If I have enough time, then I'll start putting things on. I've tried to conduct our portion as expeditiously as we could. I mean, there are hundreds of documents that have been put in evidence, any one of which, for instance, the document on drills and how to commit larceny and burglaries and breaking and entering, we could spend, it's a multi-page document, we could spend 4 days on that document. Now, in the final 2 hours that we've been allocated, the 2 hours is both argument and the presentation of further evidence as under the rules. And in fact, if the Scientologists had chosen to present further evidence, then I would have chosen to present further evidence also. In fact, I have a witness who I held for that purpose, which I'm not going to take the time to go into because I would suggest to you that there, in our investigative efforts in the last 3 years, there are another 50 or 100 such witnesses, if they had the courage to come forward, would come before you and testify also. But I am going to put in a few more pieces of evidence. Now, one of the items is a book called What is Scientology? And we're going to offer this into evidence, and we'll do it when I conclude my presentation, for a number of different reasons pertaining to the confidentiality of auditing, the disclaimer that is required under article or device, and representations that are made to members of the Church of Scientology. There is an extensive biography in here of Mr. Hubbard. Now, it's pertinent because this particular volume is one of their largest collections of information about what the organization is and how it presents itself. And already in evidence, you have some biographies about Mr. Hubbard, which is going to be one of the first areas I'm going to address. You already have some evidence on that subject, and this is going to give you a little more. I would submit that the biographic outline of Mr. Hubbard in this document, as it has been changed through the years to conform to specific facts in prior biographies, which are still published, but aren't published as much or disseminated perhaps as broadly as this one, will show you what the organization has done as they have learned about some of the representations about Mr. Hubbard's background. In the last 30 years, I would suggest to you that the Guardian's office is a particularly skillful intelligence gathering operation. And I would suggest to you that they have learned some facts, which at perhaps at another commission hearing or at another date could be gone into in considerable detail, but I would suggest to you that the organization itself over 30 years learned something about Mr. Hubbard. And I would suggest that the few biographies that we've put into evidence together with this biography, which we saved, will show you how skillfully they have rewritten their latest biography. And yet all of the suggestions and all of the inferences that are made and the facts that are set forth, the way the sentences are put together, will show you that they are suggesting the same thing that they said in biographies years ago, which are already in evidence, namely that he was a graduate of George Washington University, Princeton University, four-year combat veteran who healed his war wounds, that he was crippled and blinded from the war, and he healed those wounds through the power of Dianetics and auditing, that he's a nuclear physicist, that he has years of research and case studies, and his preparation of Dianetics, and that those all of those facts are to be relied on. I would suggest to you that the early biographies specifically make those statements. The later biographies put the sentences together in such a way as to suggest those statements in those instances. And as the witnesses testified on briefing courses, of which unfortunately we don't have the videotapes that are shown to people in briefing courses, but a number of witnesses testified about, including Mr. Walters. On briefing courses, they're told those things, but the public doesn't get the briefing courses. They're told specifically, and it is common knowledge among Scientologists. As Mr. McKee said, he gave him some poetic license because he's got an engineering background and he's a fairly mature, sophisticated man. But you take an 18-year-old kid who's over at Fort Harrison working 17 to 18 hours a day for $9.60 a week, and the inferences that he may draw as opposed to those that Mr. McKee may draw are significantly different, and that's an important fact for this commission to consider. In addition to that, just the very pattern of change can suggest to you deception, and in courtrooms across this country, it's done every day in a judicial proceeding. Among the things that this book says right at the beginning is what is called standing order number one. Laurie Taverna testified on the SO1 line. Well, at the time, the SO1 line, I'm sure, went over everyone's head. The SO1 line, as some of the documents will show, is standing order number one. Standing order number one of the Church of Scientology is that everything that is written to Ron is received by Ron. And it is designed and induced to motivate that individual to believe that L. Ron Hubbard, the Scientologist, the scientist, nuclear physicist, the man of great training and skill who has developed this technology, is always there, will always help, will always correct, and will see to it that everything he's represented is true. And one of the very first pages in the book is standing order number one. You can always write to Ron. In every org you go in, including the Fort Harrison, you'll find that right in the lobby, probably. I've never been in the Fort Harrison, but I know it's in every building. All mail addressed to me shall be received by me. I am always willing to help. By my own creed, a being is only as valuable as he can serve others. Any message addressed to me and sent to the address of the nearest Scientology church listed in this book will be forwarded to me directly. Well, on the very first page, I would submit to you that that's a deception. I would submit to you that L. Ron Hubbard doesn't know Tonya Burden, well, did not know that when Tonya Burden was complaining, as her affidavit states, which is an exhibit in this case, of the conditions in the cadet org in Los Angeles in 1973 when the milk was laden with maggots. And she wrote as a 13-year-old child, as her affidavit says, on SO1, I submit to you that Ron didn't do anything about it, as her affidavit shows, which is in evidence. In connection with the creed to which Mr. Hubbard referred, Mr. Hoffman has just indicated to me, and this is not on file in the proceedings, but we will file it to you. In one case, they filed an affidavit saying that SO1 is not quite accurate. The mail doesn't go to Ronnie. And we will file that to you and mark it as an exhibit. Some of the things that Mr. Hubbard refers to in his creed are the following. That all men have inalienable rights to think freely, to talk freely, to write freely their own opinions, and to counter or utter or write upon the opinions of others. Well, there's many things in this creed, and I'm not going to go through them all because I don't have the time, but they're all of a similar type. But on just that one, I would submit to you that you heard from Paulette Cooper on her ability to write freely. With regard to Mr. Hubbard's background, we've heard a lot of evidence. I think virtually every witness testified that to some degree or another, they relied on it, or that they would not have joined if they knew that it had been falsified. Some gave testimony of more specific reliance than others. Some people, like Mr. McKee, said he gave them poetic license. Well, I wonder, you know, that was for Mr. McKee, that was 24 years ago, he was a lot younger, and the memory tends to lapse a little bit, but we'll take his testimony on the faith. And, you know, maybe he developed a poetic license over the years. Maybe he relied on it a little more strongly when he was younger than he did now. And I would suggest to you that that is an area in which you scrutinize every witness. Just because they're the witness presented by the consultant doesn't mean you can't scrutinize as to whether or not his memory 24 years ago would have been a little bit better. Whether it supports what the consultant is alleging, or whether what the Scientologists have failed to allege and come before you and prove. From both sides of the fence, as I think I tried to instruct you at the outset, you can look at this evidence impartially from many different directions, not just as to whether it proves the Scientologists have done a certain thing. But I believe most witnesses, Taverner, Kelly, Pace, and Ray, Van Schaik, Peterson, Mayer, and Dardano, either testified that they specifically relied on it, that they generally relied on it, or that they would not have done it if they'd known that it was false. Now, his credentials about being a war hero, well, let's take being a war hero. Now, the chronology that we put into evidence of Mr. Hubbard's naval background shows you his duty stations. It shows you where he was every time he changed duty throughout the war. Now, we didn't have the time to go list them one by one at every 3 month change, but if you take the time and you read through them, you'll see where Mr. Hubbard was. You'll see that he was not a commander of corvettes in the South Pacific, as he says in one statement. You'll see that he was not battling submarines in the North Atlantic, as he says in another statement. Just that simple little document will show you where he was during the time he was in the Navy. With regard to his wounds, we're going to put into evidence a Veterans Administration physical examination of Mr. Hubbard that will give you his physical history and what he suffered from while he was in World War II. He didn't have any combat wounds. He had a duodenal ulcer primarily, for which he was treated at the Oak Knoll Military Hospital, at least on the face of the records, for 3 months at the end of the war, shortly after he was discharged from duty 24 hours after the Coke bottle was found on board the USS Alcohol, which a few days later, as I suggested to you, and I would further say that at this point we have not put into evidence anything as to where the Alcohol went. I'm not sure it's even important, but in any event, what is important is that he was discharged from duty 24 hours later after he found the Coke bottle. And then shortly thereafter, he ended up as an inpatient for 3 months in a hospital. And then shortly thereafter, or some, well, actually it would be a couple of years thereafter, which in itself is of significance, he wrote a letter to the Veterans Administration saying he was mentally ill. There are all types of issues as to how long he was mentally ill, how mentally ill he was, and how much that affected his judgment, not only during that period of time, but subsequently when he was writing Dianetics and when he did his 30 years of case studies. All of those pieces of evidence have many different inferences that could be argued about. Inferences can be drawn, legal inferences could be drawn and presented to a trier of fact in a judicial proceeding. As an investigative body, it's not even necessary, but it gives you some indication, some specific fact upon which you can draw inferences and derive some knowledge about his background. And I'm not suggesting that Mr. Hubbard's background is the most important issue in this proceeding. It's one of the more important issues because everything stems from him. But I would suggest to you that there are more important issues. But the evidence that we've introduced, together with DeWolf's testimony, well, DeWolf recanted at some point under duress, which he says under duress. Well, legally under duress, it wouldn't even be a recantation if, in fact, it was under duress, which is a separate issue in itself. But even if you assumed that it wasn't under duress and it was a retraction, then you would have to look into what he retracted. Well, we haven't even bothered going into that peripheral issue because it's so peripheral in light of everything else. But I've read the retraction, and I will say nothing more about it. I hope the Church of Scientology had walked into and presented evidence on the retraction. And we left the issue open so they could present the retraction to you, which they chose not to do, so you could read the retraction and see what it is, as Mr. Caldebank very incisively pointed out, what the retraction was. We'll leave that issue there. But I suggest to the church right now, if they're listening, bring the retraction over.
Would you enter that retraction into evidence?
If you people would like to see it, we'll put in the retraction.
Since
it's been raised as an issue. But I would suggest to you, it's in light of everything else, it's relatively peripheral. But we'll bring the retraction in. Even if he had retracted, there are issues as to, well, as would in any judicial proceeding, you can believe all of his evidence or none of his evidence. You can believe part of it, accept part, discard part. The issue for you with regard to Mr. DeWolf, after looking to him, listening to him, where he openly told you that he had made a retraction under oath, is to determine whether what he said you thought was basically true. He had mistakes in dates, he had mistakes in dates. He had mistakes in subject matter, he had mistakes in subject matter. If he didn't, he didn't. Weighing it against everything else, it's for you to correlate all those things and to determine whether basically the thrust of his testimony that his father was a fake was true or false in conjunction with all of the other evidence. And as you may recall, he said 99% of it was false. And as I previously suggested, there are a number of exhibits and evidence which corroborate his testimony. In some cases it's of importance, in other cases it's of less importance. And for the record, I would specifically refer to Exhibit 20, Exhibit 21, Exhibit 22, and Exhibit 23. One other point. The reason that, as I suggested in my opening, Mr. Hubbard's background is of significance is because Scientology, as you have seen from the mouths of the witnesses and from some of the publications, is not presented to people here in Clearwater as, I would suggest to you, a belief in a mystical religious subject. And I'm not going to get into religion here. I was just picking up this particular news coverage this morning of this publication. It's presented with the invariability of physical science. That's how it's presented. And Mr. Hubbard's background is designed to be promoted in such a way as a nuclear physicist And as I suggested to you before, inferentially, a medical doctor. At least inferentially. But definitely a nuclear physicist. In the, as this book, What is Scientology, if I took the time to read it, would show to you, the presentation is one of science. But these are specific items that have been researched, evaluated, correlated, and through the scientific method demonstrated to be scientifically accurate, upon which scientific representations and guarantees and promises are made. Therefore, the link in all of the publications about the subject matter is irrevocably tied to Mr. Hubbard's background. If they had someone from an ashram in India who had never been to school in his life and who felt that if you believe in whatever you want to believe in, you'll be cured, I would submit to you that's none of our business. But if you present an individual falsely to induce people to think that it's not belief, but it's science upon which you can rely and upon which guarantees can be made, then that is something, as the article or device case specifically says, you can deal with and you can correct. Also, Mr. Hoffman has just pointed out to me, in Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, which was purchased by someone within your city in the last now probably 72 hours, or perhaps further, perhaps 3 or 4 days ago, the opening page after the outline of a table of contents, following statement, Dianetics is an exact science, and its application is on the order of, but simpler than, engineering.
Pardon me, what page is that on?
That's on page Roman numeral 9, which is the first page after the table of contents, which is the synopsis of the book. And I would suggest to you that in the book, which is an altogether additional issue, are many case studies, which I don't have the time to go into, but it's filled with case studies, years and years of case studies, which
is that published by Dynely Press, by his own publishing company, or by a recognized publisher of books?
Most of the publications are by the Church of Scientology of California. This particular publication is by Bridge Publications, Inc., wholly owned by the Church of Scientology in Los Angeles, California. Regardless of who published it, it's disseminated and sold by the Church of Scientology of California in the city of Clearwater without the warning required by the article or device case.
We had testimony that Paulette Cooper was sued for her book because they alleged that it was false, misleading, etc., etc. Why can't that Bridge Corporation be sued also?
Well, Paulette Cooper was sued, and her book was taken to England by the church, and she was sued there. And both her publisher and she did not have the financial wherewithal to defend, so that today, to this day, the book is not on the market. There were many lawsuits that she testified filed against her. She could not financially withstand them, and the book was not, the publisher did not continue in the publication of the book. If that book had in fact been published and people knew for the last 30 years, or in this, well, in her case, in the last 12 years or 14 years, what this organization was about, for 12 years, what this organization was about, then I would suggest to you that there would be a lot more truth on the subject of Scientology than was suppressed by all of the lawsuits that prevented that publication from being published. To answer your question directly, it was sued by the Food and Drug Administration and Nathan Bodell. And the article or device case did originate from that publication, among others. And if you read the article device case, which I believe for the record is in 355 F sup at page 371. If you read that case, you will see there's an appendix in the back of the case, and I believe, and the record will correct me if I'm wrong, that the first exhibit attached to the court's opinion is Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, and representations contained therein, which resulted in that warning, which was put in as an exhibit. But to stop you, Jim Caldebank, or the city of Clearwater, or Lavinda Van Schaik, or Paulette Cooper, or George Meister, or Jack Clark, or someone, Brown McKee, would have to bring a lawsuit, hire a lawyer, pay the lawyer to bring the lawsuit, to challenge the publication. And you heard testimony about how much money the organization earns. You can draw your own inferences as to your ability to fight an organization with that money, that kind of money. And also, as I suggested to you before, you can contact Nathan Dodell in the Food and Drug Administration and find out from him personally what it took to litigate that one case. With regard to the confidentiality of auditing information, which, in my professional judgment, is, at least from the point of view of basic human rights, one of the fundamental issues before this commission. It may not be as concrete as whether there are 10 or 15 or 25 people in a room. But in terms of what I suggest to be the insidiousness of this organization, and what I suggest to be the level of deception practiced by this organization, is one of the most fundamental issues to be considered by the commission and scrutinized as to what the commission can do to inform people who come to your city that their auditing information over the last whatever number of years that the evidence shows has been used for the purpose that the evidence shows it has been used for. Aside from the issues of the monetary issues of the money that's extracted based on representations of what auditing does, aside from those issues, the information that is on deposit about human beings over in that organization and what that organization has done with that information is a very significant issue for this city to consider. I have seen, and the evidence is, I put it, some of the documents and evidence to show you people the types of things that are in this information. And some of the documents pertain to, as you will see, some political figures, not in this city and not even in this state. But when an individual is subjected to e-meter auditing or a security check, and he's required to disclose every crime that he knows that he did, that his mother did, his father did, his brothers and sisters did, his uncle did, his best friend did, and at any point in time that information becomes useful for either investigative purposes by the organization or to directly use, they can go investigate the uncle, the brother, the sister, and if the information is given in specific enough details by the individual who's being audited, all they have to do is go to those documents. So if they want to find out whether or not Paul Hatchett's cousin, God forbid, did something in 1972 at such and such a location, all they have to do is go to that auditing information and then go check that place at that time for whatever purpose they're looking into. The possession of that kind of information in an organization that uses it the way it uses it is a very substantial issue before this commission. There are highly respected members of the clergy, and there are churches throughout the United States, and there are psychiatrists throughout the United States, and there are doctors throughout the United States, and there are lawyers throughout the United States who are given highly confidential information. that is protected by very specific law, where the lawyer, the doctor, the psychiatrist, the clergyman cannot disseminate that information without the permission of the individual. Well, this organization in this city, through laws I submit in this city, which can be enforced directly in this city to deal with this particular problem, which is, as you heard from the nature of the income that's being derived in this city, at least equal to every other organization around the United States, is of paramount concern in Clearwater, as opposed to Las Vegas, Nevada, or Boston, Massachusetts, or even New York City, or even perhaps Los Angeles, California. If in fact the evidence is true that the income in Clearwater is equal to every other place in the United States, including Los Angeles, the magnitude of the problem that you are deliberating upon becomes apparent. And the bulk of information possessed by the organization in this city about people around the world who are paying money in this city becomes apparent. And the use of that information in the way that it's used, as has been demonstrated in very small degree, I suggest, in the evidence that we've presented. And there's a lot of evidence, but based on the evidence that could have been presented, I suggest to you it's in a very small degree. Something has got to be done. Something has got to be done to protect a 19-year-old David Ray when he wants to leave the organization, to not be required to sign a statement saying he did all these things, to indeed lure him back in into what could at least be described as indentured servitude. Or, if he wants to get out and he wants to come to Mayor LaShare or the Consumer Protection Officer in the city of Clearwater, he should be able to come and say, this is what the organization did to me, without fear that that organization or its attorneys are going to walk in before an official body and say, this is what David Ray is. The manipulation of people to prevent them from exposing the truth, whatever peccadilloes are in their background, when the truth of what a particular organization is much more significant and substantial than some minor peccadillo, are two competing interests that this city has got to substantially weigh. Take, for instance, the testimony of Mr. Mayor. He was sent on 18 missions, if I remember the testimony correctly. He read from a telex. He described a situation in Manchester, England, where he went to a medical doctor and blackmailed him. That was basically what he said. If you go back over the record, I suggest that that's what it'll tell you. He went to Scotland, he went to Hawaii, and blackmailed some woman with threats of bestiality that he had from her auditing folder to get her to do a particular thing. In some cases, I think there was some evidence to raise the stats to get the income up. Well, you know, I would suggest to you common sense would indicate that if you are in charge of raising the stats in Hawaii and someone of Mr. Mayor's ability or whoever else runs this organization now comes to you with that type of information, and it's an or else type thing, and you're already working 15 to 17 hours a day, maybe you would be induced to be a little more vigorous, to make a little more misrepresentations, or to do anything like convince him he's loony to get money into that organization. The suggestibility factors alone on that issue with an operative like Mr. Mayor or some of these other skilled people coming with that information to a person to get them to be a little more aggressive in their solicitation practices in the collection of income is a substantial issue before this commission, aside from all the other issues with regard to the use of the information for purposes of extortion, blackmail, manipulation, or whatever.